Hello, and welcome to episode 141 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control, and on this week's episode, we're joined by Professor John Burgess of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy for a discussion about the law of the sea. We talk about the origins of the law of the sea, its major tenets, and how it continues to affect the maritime security domain to this day. This podcast was recorded just before the very recent release of a primer on the law of the sea, which both Professor Burgess and I had the privilege of serving as authors. We'll put a link to that document on the website if you're interested in learning more. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Professor John Burgess of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Professor Burgess, thank you very much for being with us on Sea Control today.
It's my pleasure.
As is Sea Control tradition, please tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about what are the main formative experiences you had that brought you from where you were to where you are today.
Well, I'm a professor of practice here at the Fletcher School, and that's after having worked in law firms for about 35 years. But I did always have an interest in national and maritime security. I took a sabbatical and worked for the U.S. State Department in the area, and I'd say the majority of my published articles were in the U.S. Naval Institute proceedings. So moving towards maritime security and law of the sea as part of the courses I taught here was a pretty natural progression for me.
I guess I'll probably start the other podcast off by mentioning the fact that you have a very robust library of maritime books. So I'm curious, how then, you know, you've done maritime work, but what got you interested in maritime law in the first place? Was it a personal experience, or was it kind of discovering a happenstance through your legal work, or what brought you to maritime law?
Well, I've always, of course, being in a place like Fletcher, been interested in international law. And it's interesting the way fashion works sometimes. The law of the sea, as we'll talk about later, the principal convention was adopted back in 1994. The course was taught for a while, but then dropped out of the curriculum. And the more I looked at the issues, the more odd that seemed, because the law of the sea, as embodied in the Law of the Sea Convention, is one of the most comprehensive pieces of international law that exists. And it covers, obviously, 90% of the planet, and it raises all the classic issues of international law, how nations work together, how disputes are settled, how resources and rights are allocated, and it crystallizes all of those issues, and we face the questions in disputes and developments every day. And so that led me to really wanting to focus on it in a systematic way. And of course, here at a School of International Relations, it was a great venue to be able to apply the law to a very rapidly developing set of global situations.
Well, let's talk then about the historical underpinnings that have led us to where we are now before we get too far into the current issues. Yeah. So the law of the sea, tell us a little bit about it. What is it? You've talked a little bit about its effects, but what is it functionally at its core? Why does it exist? What's the history behind it? And how did it come to be?
To summarize concisely, the law of the sea, and one of the reasons it's so interesting, is it's both very old and as new as today. When nations began trading, gradually maritime custom and maritime law developed governing those relationships. And by the 17th century, international legal thinkers were beginning to think about the ocean as a separate legal space that was not owned by any nation or controlled by any nation, but was a common shared for commerce and navigation among the world's nations. And that concept has evolved as part of customary international law for centuries. After the Second World War, in a more complicated world in some ways, increasing numbers of nation states, technology that permitted greater exploitation of oceanic resources, nations began to focus on that system of customary law and whether it should be embodied in a treaty or treaties. And back in 1958, under UN auspices, a preliminary group of treaties was adopted, but their scope was limited. And that led to a desire to address, on a comprehensive basis, the issues of law of the sea. And over 10 years, dozens of nations in a conference on law of the sea worked to evolve what has become today the Law of the Sea Convention, a treaty regarding the law of the sea, which became effective in 1994. And it is very, very detailed and very broad in its scope. It did several revolutionary things. It defined on a systematic basis a series of maritime zones, parts of the ocean over which states had different rights, and particularly introduced a concept that we can spend a few more minutes on later, of an exclusive economic zone, the right of coastal states to exploit the living and non-living resources of the adjacent waters out to 200 nautical miles. It also crystallized in a written form the rights of maritime nations to freely navigate, that idea that there is an element of the commons that is available for free navigation, the conduct of trade, the conduct of naval operations. And at one level, the 1994 treaty, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, is a great compromise that assures developed nations and maritime nations the traditional rights of access and navigation, and developing nations and others the right to exploit neighboring living and non-living resources in the sea. And of course, for some countries, it's both. The United States draws great value from its economic zones off its oceans in terms of fishing, mineral, petroleum, other resources. And as the world's leading naval power, it's critical to the United States to be able to exercise the rights of navigation that are embodied in that treaty.
So before we go into some of those areas and get into the specifics, I was wondering if you could tell us, since many of us already know what customary international law is, but I'm sure there are some people out there that haven't worked in the international relations of the legal space. Yeah. But walk us through what is customary international law, and then if that is a form of law, why then would there need to be a treaty and a convention to institutionalize that in paper?
Customary international law is sets of practice that are adhered to by the international community as evidenced by state practice, what nations do, as evidenced by the supporting actions of international courts and adjudication bodies and commentators, that isn't written down in a law book, but which, by reason of practice over the course of time and the acquiescence of the international community, takes on the nature of law. And that is an historic element of international law and is relevant to the law of the sea to this day. The issues with customary international law, however, is it's neither comprehensive. Things can develop because of technological enabling or security issues that the law hasn't addressed before. And you can't rely on the accumulation of custom to address. And it's interpretation is limited in scope. It comes up as academic commentators write articles, as courts interpret decisions. And with something as complicated as the governance of the world sees, something more comprehensive, something that was more up to date in many respects was critical. I'll just throw out one example, and that relates to environmental issues, protection of the oceanic environment. For a variety of reasons, there was no substantial body of customary international law on that topic, and it could have taken decades or longer for it to evolve. And by then, environmental issues in the 20th century with respect to the world's oceans could be critical. So one of the things the treaty does is systematically set up a regime for addressing those questions. You can't do that with customary international law. You need a treaty.
So let's start going through the treaty then. You mentioned there's a number of different areas, but you mentioned first and foremost the fact that the ocean is divided into different zones.
Yes, that's right.
So walk us through those zones. Mm-hmm. What are they? How are they determined? And what can states do in those different zones?
I'd be happy to. I'm going to walk it through beginning close to land and heading out to sea. And in principle, the rights of a coastal state are highest, this makes sense, closest to land, and are more limited as you go out to sea. Internal waters, which are the waters on the landward side of the low tide line, are in essence sovereign territory. Those waters are fully subject to the laws of the state. And if you're on the Connecticut River, you're under U.S. and Connecticut law as an internal water. But then, on the other side of that baseline that's created to determine the outer limit of internal waters, you're in what's called the territorial sea. The territorial sea has a breadth of up to 12 miles. States can define it, and most do, out to 12 miles. And states, in essence, are sovereign over the territorial waters along their coasts as well. They have the full ability to legislate and enforce their laws in those waters, subject to one very important right that we can talk about later, which is a right of innocent passage by third-party states to traverse the waters, subject to limitation. But that's it. That's really the only exception or limitation on the coastal state's sovereignty. The next key zone is the one I described to you, the one that really was created under the Convention on the Law of the Sea, and that is an exclusive economic zone. That goes out all the way to 200 miles. And it says that the coastal states have the exclusive right in that zone to exploit the living and non-living resources, the seabed, what's under the seabed, petroleum, fish, mineral rights. But those otherwise are part of the high seas. They can't restrict navigation in the way they can in territorial waters. And their rights are therefore limited as opposed to territorial waters. Once you get beyond 200 miles, it is the high seas, a commons that the world continues to have rights to navigate in. Below the surface after 200 miles, there may continue to be rights to exploit minerals under the extended continental shelf. That continental shelf set of rights can extend, depending on the geology, it's a complicated equation of a coastal state, out beyond 200 miles. But typically not beyond 350 miles as an outer limit. And beyond that, the seabed again becomes part of the common. It's open to exploitation by all nations, whether they have access to the coast, whether they're landlocked or not, under a separate regime established under the treaty.
So it's pretty intuitive then in terms of the rights of different zones and how they're allocated for large bodies of land. So say, for example, knowing how far the end of California is from, you know, 200 miles, that's pretty easy.
It is, yeah.
But there are also, I mean, the ocean's a big place, so there's a lot of other features, I guess is the technical terminology from there.
Yeah.
And I think one of my favorites from the Law of the Sea Convention is the difference between islands and rocks.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you could walk us through what the differences between those two features are and how they play into the Law of the Sea.
Yeah, I'm always reminded of the old Simon and Garfunkel song, I am a rock, I am an island, but it's actually a legal concept here, not a musical one. And the key point is that, as you described, if you're along a continental coastline, it's pretty intuitive. You know, you get 12 miles, you get 200 miles. It's a small percentage relative to the size of the continent. But how do you treat an island? And an island is defined under the convention as a body of land surrounded by water that's above sea level at high tide. And it actually, that is an island, creates a territorial sea and an EEZ as well. So if you're looking at the Florida Keys, individual islands that remain above high tide, they can create, they'd have the potential to create a territorial sea and an EEZ all on their own. So I'm going to indulge for a second, if it's okay, in a little geometry. Let's say you're in the middle of the Pacific and you've got an island that is a mile wide. Well, it can create a territorial sea and an exclusive economic zone. I'm not great at geometry, but I think the area of a circle is pi r squared. So 200 miles, square it, 40,000 miles, multiply it by pi. A 1 mile island can create tens of thousands of square miles of exclusive economic rights. Interestingly enough, by the way, that means that the nations that have the largest EEZs in the world are the United States, because of the range of islands principally that are United States territory in the Pacific. And surprisingly enough, the next one is France.
France.
France. And to understand that, you need to look at a map and go, oh yeah, French Polynesia, or the islands that France controls in the Indian Sea, Indian Ocean rather. And how did they get so big? Because of this leverage. And the drafters of the Law of the Sea Convention, they kind of knew that. They said, we have to safeguard the abuse of that status. So only one kind of island gets those rights. There's a subset of islands we're going to call rocks. And those are islands that can't sustain human habitation or economic activity. They don't have to be literally rocks. They could be a sand spit. They could be a coral reef. But if they lack the capacity to support human habitation in a meaningful way or meaningful economic activity, then they do not generate an EEZ. And it eliminates that ability to leverage so dramatically the territory of an island to, in essence, be able to create very, very significant and valuable oceanic zones. So they thought of it, but it's still an issue in today's law.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because obviously then the incentive for a country that owns a rock, you know, if it's not the size of Oahu, which has Honolulu on it, but is kind of the cartoon depiction of sort of a person on a tiny deserted island
with one palm tree on it.
Incentive, I'm sure, for a country with that in order to gain those exclusive economic rights is to say, oh, well, that can sustain human habitation.
Yes.
So I was wondering, how then is it determined whether a piece of land in the water is an island or a rock?
Yeah.
You have the sort of the definitions, but then how do you define then human habitation? Well, human habitation is pretty easy, but economic activity seems to be kind of fuzzy.
Actually, both of them are pretty tricky. And as typically happens, the treaty doesn't give you a lengthy piece of guidance on how to do that. And many nations, including the United States, have, I'll use the phrase, been liberal in their interpretation of whether a feature is an island for the reasons you described. But in last summer, an international tribunal on the South Seas, South China Sea in particular, which we'll talk about, looked at that question and provided some more detailed interpretation, and it said a few things. First of all, when we evaluate whether an island can sustain human habitation or economic life, we're going to look at the island in its natural state. So for starters, if the Chinese or somebody else build a huge structure or transform the island, you can't look at that. You have to go back historically and see what it looked like before human intervention transformed it. Secondly, you're going to look at the ability to sustain human life without massive outside intervention. If you fly in lots of people, you fly in water, fly in food, it's clear that those external interventions, again, aren't the test. You have to look at what is there on the island. And interestingly enough, it doesn't necessarily have to have a human population. The question is there water? Are there resources to supply food, whether it's vegetation or animal or fish, that could or does sustain a human population? And not on a transitory basis. People coming through for 2 months a year to fish doesn't count. Secondly, they also, in the tribunal, took a hard look at what economic activity or life would mean and underscored that it couldn't be merely extractive. You know, there are islands that were made of bird dung, guano, and in the 19th century, people would go and mine these islands. Well, that's just extractive. That's not economic life. There has to be some set of resources that would permit economic activity on the island, and that could be mining, it could be fishing, but it can't simply be mining that can't not sustain and does not sustain a local population. That still raises lots of factual questions in every case, but it does make clear that an island has to be something more than just a palm tree and someone waiting for the ship to come to qualify. And that's going to have implications for nations like the U.S. and France and others that have significant island claims.
So we understand a bit about the zones, how they're built, how they're projected out, and some of the controversies surrounding that, which we'll get into the specifics in a bit. But to set the groundwork for everyone out there in our audience, tell us a little bit about what you alluded to earlier about innocent passage and freedom of navigation. What is it? How does it function? And how does the Law of the Sea Convention define those different kinds of activities? What are the rules of the road?
And those are critical elements, because really the Law of the Sea is a balancing of interests of states. The coastal states want to control as much as possible, as far as possible, and obviously maritime and commercial states wish to be able to conduct trade and activities without interference by coastal states. And those compromises are reflected in a couple of different concepts. The first is the concept of innocent passage. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the sovereign coastal state has a lot of power and authority in the territorial sea, subject to one exception, and that is that vessels of third parties can traverse the territorial sea to make a transit or to enter into the ports of the coastal state under a doctrine of innocent passage. The coastal state cannot forbid that kind of transit or activity. And when you think about it, that's fairly critical to commerce. A cargo ship proceeding along the U.S. coast in order to trade, in order to access U.S. ports, in order to efficiently transit, is going to enter territorial waters. And this right of innocent passage allows it to do so. But it's a very limited right. The passage has to be continuous. It has to be expeditious. You can't anchor off a coast for a week absent an emergency set of circumstances. So it's got that test. And it has a variety of other tests that is designed to assure that innocent passage isn't exploited to take advantage of the coastal state's resources or military security. For example, you can't fish on innocent passage because that is in conflict with the rights of the coastal state. You can't operate military systems. You can't take on or land aircraft or launch aircraft. Submarines have to proceed on the surface, which kind of spoils the whole purpose of being a submarine, precisely to avoid provocative threats to the security, safety of the coastal state. So that's the balance that's achieved.
So let's talk a little bit about the territorial disputes, the specific...
And actually, I apologize. Yeah. If I could take a second, though, on transit rights as well. Transit rights relate to a very specific kind of territorial water, and that's international straits. Straits of water that connect bodies of the high seas or economic zones. And you can think of lots of examples, the Straits of Gibraltar, the Straits of Malacca, places which are narrow waterways that would be the territorial waters of the contiguous states. But this special set of transit rights is granted. And it's rather like innocent passage. But because international straits are so critical to global security and commerce, the rules are more relaxed. I mentioned submarines couldn't proceed on a submerged basis in innocent passage. They can in transit rights. The number of restrictions on activities in transit rights is much more limited than for innocent passage. And aircraft have transit rights as well as vessels. In innocent passage, only surface vessels or submarines have that right. So it's a more liberal regime, which is a critical regime to assuring global access to those straits that are fundamental choke points in the conduct of global commerce.
There's also a concept inside the Law of the Sea called sovereign immunity.
Yes.
I was wondering, since that's at least tangentially connected to the innocent passage and freedom of navigation rules, walk us through. What is sovereign immunity? What does that mean?
Well, it's more than in the Law of the Seas. It's really a doctrine of international law that states will not conduct criminal or adversarial actions against other states. And when you think about it, it's an element of comity, and we don't want France interfering with U.S. military aircraft or ships, and France similarly does not want us doing the same with theirs. But its significance for the Law of the Sea is that many of the provisions of the Law of the Sea exempt vessels that are subject to sovereign immunity or aircraft that are subject to sovereign immunity. For instance, the anti-pollution provisions don't apply to a U.S. warship or a French warship for that matter. In innocent passage, it's an interesting dynamic because it basically says that if a ship that has the right to sovereign immunity violates the ground rules for innocent passage, the coastal state has the right to take steps to ask it to cease the passage. What that means isn't entirely clear, and it's not by, it is in fact very likely there's no right of force or coercive ability to force a sovereign immune vessel to change its course of conduct. So there's implicit in that a risk of standoff, and certainly the rights against sovereign immune vessels are more limited. And state interference with those kind of vessels is a very serious breach, not just of law of the sea, but of international law, which was why when the Chinese picked up a drone operated by a U.S. vessel, which is subject to sovereign immunity, it was a U.S. government vessel, although not a naval ship as such, that raises implications of a breach of sovereign immunity.
So then let's talk about some of the specific examples, since you mentioned China, since that's the one that probably most people out here in podcast world are familiar with. Right. Walk us through the South China Sea. Why is the law of the sea a part of the disputes happening there? What does it say about the disputes that have been happening, and how has it generally guided sort of the developments that have happened in that region?
Well, in some ways, it's a textbook example of the importance of the law of the sea, because the South China Sea is fraught with conflict. There are small islands, the Spratlys, for instance, the Paracels, in the South China Sea, that are claimed by multiple adjoining states. The claims with respect to economic zones and extended continental shelf create issues of overlap and conflict. And this is in a region where suspicion and friction between the neighboring states is high. So the ground rules of the law of the sea are a critically important element in helping to resolve the frictions that are embedded in the issues I just described to you. And one of the key elements of it has been the tension between the Chinese view of its rights with respect to the South China Sea and those of adjoining states. The International Tribunal decision at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in 2016 that I mentioned earlier really arose out of that and some other related disputes. But the principal core was with respect to China's view of its rights over the South China Sea. China has asserted that it has broad sovereign rights within an area defined by a so-called nine-dash line. And that expression comes from the fact that the map that originally included it had nine dashes. The number of dashes varies from time to time. That doesn't matter. What does matter is that the line embraces the great majority of the South China Sea. It comes down close to Indonesia, to Vietnam, and to the Philippines. And the line conflicts with the exclusive economic zones of those nations. China's never defined precisely, and certainly not in the context of the law of the sea, what it means by the sovereign rights under the nine-dash line, but both verbally and in action has asserted rights that would be in conflict with the law of the sea. For instance, the access of Filipino fishers to living resources within the South China Sea has been restricted by the Chinese on the basis of the nine-dash line. The tendency of China to increasingly enforce or assert the nine-dash line was triggered when Vietnam and the Philippines began oil exploration in the South China Sea. And the tribunal took a hard look at the nine-dash line, and it unequivocally said that this line, which China asserts has its origins in ancient historic rights to the sea, is in conflict with the Convention on the Law of the Sea, and hence is legally of no effect. The tribunal said that when China signed the convention, it gained great rights, including to the EEZ around China that didn't exist before. And in doing so, also lost any more vague and historic claims. And that was a very important decision, both legally and geopolitically. There's no question that legally it was the right decision. This kind of broad, inchoate historic right to great reaches of water doesn't exist anywhere in the law of the sea. And in addition, it was a firm message that from a political standpoint, China's position was an overreaching assertion of sovereign rights, which is one of the reasons why the Chinese have so bitterly denounced the decision.
So let's talk about the other end of that, since we've talked mostly about the economic rights. Let's talk about freedom of navigation mm-hmm. in yeah. the South China Sea, because you mentioned the drone seizure.
Yeah.
What then does the law of the sea say should be happening in the South China Sea? And what is the position of China, how they're acting, and how do they contrast with one another?
Yes. The tribunal did not address that set of issues, but it has been an escalating and critical source of friction as well, particularly, although not exclusively, between the U.S. and China. And it has two elements. The first relates to innocent passage. I've described that before. It's a right for a continuous and expeditious crossing of territorial seas. Innocent passage is available to warships as well as civilian vessels. But a certain number of nations, including China, have asserted that it's necessary to provide notification and to obtain consent to conduct innocent passage. The U.S. position, which is consistent with the convention, is that that consent is not required. That war, honestly, has been more one of words than actions, and perhaps fortunately, the U.S. conducts what it calls freedom of navigation exercises from time to time to preserve those rights. It's complicated in the South China Sea because those navigation exercises have sometimes been ambiguous. The U.S. is sailed within 12 miles of certain of these small maritime features, and it's been unclear whether the U.S. is, in fact, asserting innocent passage and conceding there's a territorial sea around the feature, or the U.S. is asserting that there's no territorial sea and there's simply a high seas transit right. And that ambiguity continues. China protests those exercises. We periodically conduct them. As I said, the struggle has largely been one of words, but it is important. And as a security matter for the United States, the assertion of the right of innocent passage within the South China Sea is very important. The other and more broad question is whether there are any limitations on the conduct of military surveillance, reconnaissance, or activities within China's EEZ. And China also interprets its rights there very broadly. It asserts that the EEZ can only be used for peaceful purposes and that reconnaissance flights, this is beyond the 12 miles, remember, it's out beyond that zone, or military exercises are inconsistent with its interpretation of the convention. And that has led to serious difficulties. More than a decade now ago, there was a collision between a Chinese interceptor aircraft and a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft. The Chinese pilot was killed. His plane crashed. The U.S. aircraft was forced down to land on an emergency basis in a Chinese airbase. And unfortunately, within the last couple of years, nothing that serious has occurred, but there have been recurrent games of, for lack of a better word, international chicken between Chinese interceptor aircraft and U.S. reconnaissance aircraft. And the risk of an incident there is real and again arises from the U.S. goal of assuring, and particularly as a major power in the region and as a leading naval power, that its high seas rights are preserved. The erosion of that would be a serious blow to U.S. security interests. And China's assertions that at least within the EEZ, conduct of that nature is not allowed of absent Chinese consent.
So lest our audience out in podcast world assume that basically every tension over the law of the sea somehow involves the United States and China, or let's be honest, sometimes just China and its neighbors, tell us a little bit about the United States and Canada and its disagreements on freedom of navigation.
What could be friendlier than the United States and Canada? But things do happen when the issues are ones critical to open navigation, to the principles of law of the sea, and to access to resources. And that's shown up between the U.S. and Canada, where there's an abiding disagreement regarding the nature of the fabled Northwest Passage, the sea route through the Canadian island chain that once upon a time explorers hoped led directly to El Dorado, but now with melting Arctic ice may offer a way through the Great Circle route to significantly reduce transit time between the U.S. East Coast and Asia. And there is an ongoing disagreement between the United States and Canada regarding the nature of the Northwest Passage. The Canadian position is that they are internal waters. And if you'll recall, internal waters are equivalent to sovereign territory. There are no rights of third-party nations, and the rights abide exclusively with the coastal state. And in some ways, this has become a key psychological element to the Canadians, the Northwest Passage being truly part of the quote-unquote Canadian North or Canadian Arctic, however you define it. The U.S. perspective is rather different. It is that the Northwest Passage is in fact an international strait, a way to connect two sets of high seas, and is subject to the transit rights available to third-party nations under international law, and that therefore, for example, a U.S. ship could proceed through the Northwest Passage without consent or notification, provided that it abided by the rules applicable to transit passage. This disagreement remains more theoretical than real in the sense that traffic, obviously, through the Northwest Passage is limited. The two states have agreed to share information regarding such passages without the United States in any way acknowledging that Canadian waters are internal and without Canada acknowledging in any fashion that the Northwest Passage is an international strait. And part of the disagreement turns on what an international strait means. What does it mean to be used to permit passage between two sets of high seas or EEZs? Does real use, quote-unquote, constitute part of that definition? Because historically, transits in the Northwest Passage, relative to most other international straits, has been very, very limited. The U.S. view is that it can be used, and it has been used, whether or not it's a large number of times, and hence it's a strait. The Canadian view is that that's not the case because usage has been highly limited and doesn't correspond to what has been historically associated with international straits. There are ironies to the positions on both sides. I will note that it's not entirely clear that it would be a geopolitical victory for the U.S. if it is an international strait, because, for example, that means that Russian reconnaissance aircraft are free to fly down the straits under rights of transit. On the other hand, from a U.S. standpoint, the principle at stake is critical, because if there is any evolving body of law that erodes the definition of international straits, it's a clear detriment to a leading maritime and naval nation like the United States. So it does matter.
So the Canada issue and the strait versus internal waters alludes to the fact that the ocean is changing, and that as a result of the changes in the ocean, it is also then driving changes in the law of the sea,
right,
if not in the law itself, but in terms of evolving issues that are coming up. So besides the Canada strait versus internal waters issue, what other issues do you see coming down the pike for the law of the sea?
Well, the issue you just alluded to is one of them, and as you also mentioned, it goes well beyond the question of the Northwest Passage. as we've talked about before, the definition of the low tide line is a very important marker, one of the key ways, not the only way, but one of the key ways that the baselines from which the maritime zones are measured is defined. We had a discussion about the difference between a rock and an island. Well, imagine if, as seems to be the case, global sea levels are rising. There are currently islands that are a meter or two above sea level. Give another 50 or 100 years, and if current trends continue, that could have a fundamental impact on the definitions of maritime zones. They may be retreating landward. There are islands which would disappear, eliminating EEZs or territorial seas associated with those islands. And there's no resolution to date about whether the baseline should be frozen and the way the borders are defined today is embedded, at least for some period of time, or whether they're ambulatory, the legal word for walking around, whether they reflect the adjustments in sea level. And there are groups under the International Bar Association and UN auspices looking at it, and it's a real question. And let alone dealing with the broader question, which is not purely a law of the sea question, of what becomes of island states, small nations in the Pacific or the Indian Ocean, where it's not simply a question of maritime borders disappearing, but of a country disappearing. And what the status of the country's sovereignty and what happens to its population. So it's a good thing that that isn't going to happen in the next 5 years, because it's going to take a lot longer to resolve issues of that depth and complexity.
So as is sea control tradition, since we're approaching the end, please walk us through what it is that you're reading right now. You obviously have a very interesting and diverse background in terms of your, you know, education. So tell us a bit about what you've been reading lately, whether it's law of the sea related, maritime related, or even if it's just something fun that you found online recently.
Yeah, well, I think I described two things. One is that just a pure law of the sea book, but it covers a little bit different topic than we've been discussing, but one the audience might be interested in, is that is a book by Natalie Klein on maritime security and the law of the sea that talks about issues we really couldn't talk about today, including piracy and weapons of mass destruction and issues where there's an intersection of security issues and law of the sea. And I've also been reading a book on the Barbary Pirates, which is kind of a classic set of questions that relates to the history of U.S. frigates, but also some of these issues were present at the beginning of the United States, issues of control of piracy, freedom of navigation. If the Barbary Pirates were anything, they were dedicated to limiting freedom of navigation and exploiting the sea in a way that was at odds with freedom of commerce and of security.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much again, Professor, for being with us on Sea Control, and best of luck with all of your work, and hopefully we'll be able to welcome you back on again at some point in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That concludes episode 141 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Very special thanks to our guest this week, John Burgess, and also our newest podcast producer, Chris Lee. If you're interested in learning more about the Law of the Sea, take a look at the SimSec website for a link to the Fletcher School's recently published Law of the Sea Primer. It's a pretty nerdy topic, but since you're here listening to a podcast on the Law of the Sea, we figured you'd probably enjoy it. If you enjoyed this episode and haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.